Magic.
And the world of illusion.
Magic TV.
And Craig Petty. Proudly present the Talk Magic Podcast. Every week we bring you awesome interviews with the greatest magicians that have ever lived. And now, here's your host, Craig Petty.
Hey guys, welcome back to Magic TV. It's 9 o'clock, it's a Tuesday, and I am here with an amazing performer, and I think it's safe to say an entrepreneur in magic, Mr. Andy Gladwin. Hey Andy, how you doing?
Hi Craig, thanks for having me. This is going to be a fun chat. I'm looking forward to hearing what questions you have for me.
I am so excited. I know how busy you are running the Vanishing Ink Empire, and we're going to talk about that obviously in a bit, but thanks for finding time to pop on here.
Oh, wouldn't miss it for the world. So thanks for having me.
Amazing. Now, a lot of people know you as the better half of Josh J, Mr. Vanish Inc. But let's just start from the very beginning. So was your journey into magic the typical seven-year-old gets a magic kit and falls in love? Is that kind of where we started with this?
Yeah, I really have the most standard story. You know, I was doing magic as a kid, never gave it up. Typical, just like I'm sure you and everybody else watching. My first magic book, however, was my first serious one was The Art of Astonishment. So I kind of jumped in at the deep end. And then, yeah, went from there learning Martin Nash and becoming a real lover of magic books and the magic in general. And I've tried pretty much every area of magic, including stage illusions, which I don't tend to talk about. And, you know, right now I spend my life studying and doing card magic and close-up magic.
And did you go straight from sort of... did you go straight into full-time magic? Or the reason I ask this is because you are a very smart marketing person. I mean, I've listened to you talk about marketing, and that mustn't have been a mistake. Did you have a background in marketing and then go full-time magic, or is it something that you just decided to learn along the way?
So the truth is I never expected to become a full-time magician, and I got a job in IT. I was a computer programmer for 5 or 6 years or so. I then managed a creative team, and that led a direction, moving into a direction of marketing. My last job in kind of the real world was UK product manager for the world's largest web hosting company. So that's kind of where I learned marketing to pivot into that role. But I didn't ever see myself as a full-time gigging magician doing, you know, 5 gigs a weekend, that kind of thing. It just wasn't the thing for me. But yeah, I mean, we've known each other for years, and you know that I'm very lucky to have some friends who are just phenomenal magicians. And what tends to happen is when I was spending my life focusing on my career, they were spending their lives focusing on magic, and they were getting really, really good. And I was sat there at my desk, you know, playing with a deck of cards, thinking, why am I not as good as these guys? Why am I not progressing? And the answer is because I wasn't dedicating my life to it like they were. So basically, I left my job to study magic, and that means that I had to perform because I had to pay my bills, but my main focus was I wanted to be a better magician. I wanted to spend more time learning magic. So my career path was almost solely personal development reasons, and you know, I had to do the gigs to pay for that.
But was it a big decision taking that leap from full-time employment to being self-employed? Because that's something that a lot of people struggle with. Oh, you know, am I going to take the leap? When you've got the security of a 9-to-5 job, it's very difficult to then be in a situation where you're completely dependent on your own income.
It should have been a big decision. And I insist that everybody who makes it ensures that it is a big life decision. But it kind of wasn't, because I planned ahead, quite far ahead. I got gigs to the level where I was getting enough gigs to match my salary for a kind of a 6-month period. And I got gigs in the diary so that once I left my job, I would be able to move and still be comfortable. In fact, kind of, I joke that the best time of my career in my whole lifetime financially was actually that time when I had a full-time salary as UK product marketing manager and doing magic as well. So that was kind of a sweet time in that respect, but it was just too much work to handle for anyone. Mm. So In some ways, yes, it was a big decision, but in another way, I think I kind of carefully planned it to ensure that it wasn't a big decision. And originally, at the kind of the first month or two of starting the transition, I talked to my work about going part-time. So maybe doing 2 or 3 days a week in the office and then the rest of the time doing magic. And my boss at the time said, no, like this is a job that is, it's all or nothing. And I wonder whether he was actually doing that to do me a favor, because he knew where my passion lied. He knew that I could do this magic thing and make it work. So I think that was his way of pushing me into it. And actually, I should reconnect with him and find out for sure. But I had to do it that way. And, you know, I ended up reflecting on all of this journey of becoming a full-time magician, and I put it together in a book called Going Pro. And in my mind, that's not a book that you should profit from. I don't want to make money from that. So actually, I released it as a free ebook so that anybody can learn my process. Now, I went pro 11 years ago. Would I have gone pro now in this market, this kind of rocky economy that we might be entering? Probably not. So I'm not suggesting anyone reads that and goes, yes, quit my job tomorrow. In fact, the book is all about not doing that. But yeah, it wasn't a big decision because of the planning that went behind it. Basically, I made it easy on myself.
And you talked about how you wanted to develop and become a better magician. And I know that's something you're very passionate about. How did you go about doing that? You said you went to gigs to make money. Would you say that going to gigs is a way to actually improve as a magician and getting that experience out there? Or are there other ways that you are wanting to do that as well?
Yeah, I'm glad you said that, because maybe it came across wrong. Like, the gigs were the necessity of giving me the time to study. But actually, in my mind, you can't become a good magician unless you're performing magic. Like, that's the most essential ingredients of being a great magician. I don't think there's been any world-class magician in the world who hasn't performed frequently. Like, it's just a requirement. So yeah, it's essential in my mind. If you want to be a great magician, you have to perform a great number of shows. So yeah, it was part of the process. But I guess what I was getting at is I needed the free time to study magic and practice magic, create magic and find my voice. And yeah, once you've got started to develop that, you have to be doing gigs. And you know, I listen, one of my passions is stand-up comedy. And I listen to a lot of podcasts and interviews with comedians, famous comedians, but also comedians who are known just in the circuit. And pretty much the common trend is that a comedian will say, you can't get good unless you're working 5 or 10 times a week. And think about that in magic. That's really hard to work that many gigs in a week. Maybe that's changed a bit now with virtual magic shows. But, you know, if you want to get good, you have to perform a lot. There's no other solution.
That's right. And when you went pro, you talked about how you've done everything. You've done stage, you've done close-up, you've done stage illusions. You're known as a close-up magician. Why did you try and do everything? Was it because you wanted to have an overarching experience of everything that magic can offer? Or was it that you, what was the reasoning behind that?
I was a kid. I was exploring magic. I was, you know, reading books. I was watching magicians that I respected. You know, I would spend some time obsessing over Lance Burton and doing a manipulation. I did a manip act with a lamppost and no dubs. But, you know, as a kid, like 15 years old, it was terrible. But I was inspired by Lance. And then I watched Bill Malone's videos or DVDs, and I was inspired by Bill Malone for a while. And I think that's just the nature of exploring magic. I tried all these avenues. And yeah, I was probably 16 when I decided finally I wanted to focus and work on card magic, close-up magic. But now I'm at the point in my career where actually I've been experimenting beyond that, because I have this trick with a balloon where I get inside a giant red balloon.
It's on TV. It's brilliant.
Oh, thank you. That was again, that exploration. I'd spent all my time honing in on particular areas of close-up magic. And that was me thinking, what would I be like if I transitioned to having a stage piece? What would that character look like? And what decisions would I make? Could I even bring some of my close-up mentality into stage? So, you know, I'm always exploring and finding different areas and different avenues. But yeah, my true love and true passion is close-up magic.
And when did you start I mean, obviously you were creating magic right from when you first started for yourself. When was it that you actually started creating magic with a view to marketing it? Because way before Vanishing Ink was just a twinkle in people's eyes, you were releasing magic in a variety of different places and ebooks and this place and that place. I remember you and Rob doing a lot of creating back in the day. When did that come about? Was that as a desire to become magic famous, or was it just an outlet that you wanted to start actually, you know, creating magic just for the sake of it?
Yeah, it's a really great question. And the truth is that, yeah, never is the answer. I never started creating magic to publish it. I started enjoying publishing magic that I'd created for a while. I had lots of tricks in things like Magic Magazine and in various online magazines when I was younger. And I just enjoyed that outlet. I realize that actually the part I enjoyed the most was writing up the tricks and describing them. You know, these are tricks that I've been playing with for years, and I enjoyed the aspect of describing them. And I think part of that is actually you really start to learn about a trick when you have to describe it and teach it to somebody else. So that was really fun. As to being magic famous, it's not something I've ever really thought about, I guess. I've been lucky to have been lecturing for quite a few years and, you know, having those tricks in magazines. And it's actually probably part of my job I enjoy the most is performing and talking with other magicians. So, yeah, it was never really a desire to become magic famous. I'm not even sure whether I am magic famous. If I am, I'm, you know, CDE list famous, F list, I don't know. But, you know, it was never a desire, but it almost had become a necessity, right? If you want to do something really well, then you do need an audience to accept it. So, yeah, that's kind of where that came from, I guess.
And is that what led to the desire to write books for other people? Because again, before Vanishing Ink happened, you started writing books for other people. I remember one of my favorite books, I've got it over there on the shelf,
52
Memories. What an amazing book. Now that's one that you wrote, if I'm correct, is that right?
Yeah.
Where did writing books come into this whole thing?
Completely accidentally, actually. So Jack Parker was a close friend of mine, I think one of the greatest card magicians of our generation, creators of card magic of our generation. And Jack's work needed to be out there. It really needed magicians to see it because it was, I believe, groundbreaking. But unfortunately, there were two steps to it. First of all, Jack was writing a book where he collected tricks from some of his favorite magicians, and he called it the Magician's Limited Cookbook. And the idea was that each magician would choose a kind of easy trick, and he would combine them all and then donate the money from the book to a charity for a leukemia charity, because he suffered from leukemia when he was a kid. So it's his way of giving back. And as he started that process, he just realized he wasn't the guy to write a magic book. He really struggled with it. He was an architect, and I think he thought mostly kind of visually and struggled to write the stuff down. So he recruited me. You know, I'd never written a magic book before, but I'd certainly described my own tricks for magazines. So I was happy to help. It was for a good cause, and Jack was a good friend. So the Magician's Cookbook was released and actually sold pretty surprisingly well, now I think about it. And then a year or so after that, sadly, Jack found out that he was had just a few months left to live. He was dying of cancer, and he wanted to get his tricks out at that point. He'd always resisted writing a book. He'd kind of had lots of ebooks and smaller booklets, but he wanted a complete collection of his work. So that's basically the way I got started writing magic. It was kind of Jack's gift to me, I guess, was to allow me to write his book. And I actually ended up quitting my job so that I could get it done, because while Jack thought he had 6 months, it became quite evident quickly that maybe it wasn't going to be that long. So it became a full-time job to write that book. And then a couple of years ago, we re-released it because there were some parts that were rushed for, you know, out of necessity. So we re-released it, and I'm really proud to have it out there. And you know, here's the cool thing. The trick contained 52 of Jack's tricks, but actually there was another 52 that we held back that Jake wanted me to publish in various ways over the years. And it just, they didn't really work. You know, one of them he wanted as a marketed trick, for example, and it's just the timing was never right. And he had these other tricks he wanted to describe. So yeah, I wrote another book called 52 Explorations, which should be released in 2021. So I'm going to be excited to get that out. It's completely finished. It just needs to go to print.
That is brilliant. That is the best news. That's one of my favorite books. So that is great to hear.
And you know what's cool with 52 Explorations is you would assume, as kind of I did almost very cynically, that the best stuff was in 52 Memories. And it wasn't until I went back to 52 Explorations, you know, to all of the tricks that Jack had shared with me, there's some stuff in there that is way, way better than 52 Memories. So I think some of Jack's best tricks are in this new book. And that's not me just teasing and hyping. I mean, there is a 7-card assembly in there that is one of the best constructed card routines I've ever seen. Like, it's, the guy was just so far ahead of his time, and I'm proud to be involved in getting his legacy out there.
Well, I think that's something that you sometimes assume. Like, I remember Destroyers is one of my favorite books, Troy Hughes's Destroyers. Mm-hmm. And I remember when Vanishing Ink sent me an email in my inbox, oh, we're going to be bringing up Moments. And I'm like, nah, all the good stuff's in Destroyers. What, you can't beat Charming Chinese Challenge, Triple Double Decker and all of that stuff. Mm-hmm. And then I got Moments and I'm like, man, this is even better.
Yeah, and Moments went under the radar, really. It's out of print now, but, you know, it took a while to sell. And probably because of the same thing. People just thought, Destroyers is the best stuff. Moments has some killer stuff. And Troy has other stuff now, like that's unpublished, that it's just incredible. Yeah, he's constantly developing and evolving, as I guess we all are.
That's great. Now, before we talk about Vanishing Ink, one thing that kind of struck me, going back to when you were a performer, and that was your main thing, you always came across as very entrepreneurial. I remember, and it was almost like, I do a lot of marketing videos on this channel, and I talk about having several income streams and not just being a performer. And that's something that I've seen you do. We've never talked about this before, but I remember before Facebook was a thing, because now you've got like Magic Gig Share and all these gig sharing sites, but you were the architect of that back in the day with Post Gigs, which I think single-handedly gave Steve Deller the majority of his work when he was in London. And that's something that was revolutionary at the time. And so many close-up magicians were getting gigs through that. Was that as a desire to create a second income stream, or was it as a desire to just help take the right magician for the right client? Or what was the reasoning behind? Because it just showed to me, my gosh, Andy, and we didn't know each other very well back then, but I was looking at this and it was like, oh my God, this is such an entrepreneurial thing to do. This is a great idea.
Yeah, you know, and I can't really take any credit for it. That was all Rob's idea. You know, one thing I've always been good at, I think, is formalizing systems. And, you know, that just comes from my old job. So, you know, back in the day, Post Gigs was, I can't even remember, like a forum or something, or an email list. I don't remember the details. And, you know, I just helped build a system for it. So I take no credit. I kind of even forgotten about it until you mentioned it. So yeah, it's, that one's all Rob. But yeah, as far as kind of being entrepreneurial goes, it's just a necessity. You know, I didn't grow up in a wealthy background or anything like that. So, you know, I have to earn for myself basically. So I always realized that just having a few different avenues gives me, number one, different projects to work on. I'm kind of a project junkie. I love having things to be working on at all times. So that really helps. But number two is, you know, there's always that backup, right? Of, you know, if this goes wrong, well, at least we have that. And yeah, that's just the way I've pretty much always been. So I can't take too much credit for it, but it's just, for me, it is what it is.
Well, can you give anybody, one of the things that a lot of magicians struggle with is marketing themselves. You know, it's that old thing, isn't it? In show business, most magicians work on the show and forget about the business side of things. And you've always, you know, when you're a performer, and we'll talk about this, but when you're going out full-time performing, you were the guy that everyone talked about. Oh, I've already booked Andy Gladwin. And I remember on your At the Table lecture, you were the first guy that I saw on an At the Table go, actually, let's go and look at this monitor and start looking about marketing ideas now, shall we? I'm like, this is so cool. Because as you know, my background's marketing. Have you got any advice for magicians? Because especially now, Andy, because now with COVID, I think that people are going to need to learn modern marketing techniques. You can't just rely on the yellow pages and word of mouth anymore. Is there any advice that you can give people?
Yeah, sure. You're probably a better person for that. So if you've done videos, people should take more attention of you than me, because I don't do the kind of gigs that I used to do back then, that I was kind of trying to churn out inquiries for when I was looking for those type of gigs. So you've grown an empire out of this thing. I was just getting gigs for myself. But yeah, marketing tips I can certainly give. And you know, it's an ever-changing landscape. I haven't done those kind of gigs for 5 or 6 years now. So the one thing I would say is never forget what the product is. You know, and let me go into detail before you kind of make too many assumptions of what I'm saying there. I never forget what the product is. Like, who is the product? Well, what is the product? It's you, right? As the magician, it's you. And the best marketing, the best advertising is about providing the best product, right? So if you are the very best magician that you can be, if you're the best magician in your area, if you're the best magician in your wider area, if you're the best magician in your country, you are going to get way, way, way more gigs than if you just spend all your time focusing on SEO and marketing. So for me, it sounds like a cop-out bit of advice, but I actually think it's 100% the best advice is, if you want to focus on your marketing, focus on your performance, focus on being the best magician you can be. The marketing kind of falls in place then. But that doesn't mean you should then forget about the other stuff that you need to do. You know, I know some of the best magicians I know kind of focused fully on that and totally forgot about the fact that they have to sell themselves at the same time. So I recommend if you're naturally not a marketer, focus on your performance, get somebody in to help you do the rest of the stuff. Other kind of marketing tips, you know, the biggest one I find, and I sense, I haven't looked at your marketing, I don't look at magicians' websites anymore, Craig, but I bet you've done this, is to not have a website with everything on it. Don't have a website with your kids' shows, your close-up shows, your stage shows. Have separate websites and focus and look like an expert in that area. And I know that you have your magic party, the kids' stuff, and your illusion show, so I'm certain you market all of those individually.
Yeah.
And to me, that's just the answer. Be the best, look like the best, and work with the best to help get your message across. So it's kind of simple when I say it like that.
Amazing advice. That is actually really great advice. Now, when did you then, you talked about you haven't done gigs like that for about 5 years. That kind of brings us to Vanishing Ink. And I remember the first big project, you'd released eBooks and things, but the first big project with your name attached to it was the push off, the double DVD set on the push off deal. Was that pre Vanishing Ink, or was that around about the same time?
It was just as Vanishing Ink was starting, actually. So back then we didn't have any video production capabilities. And just like I said, if you can't be the best, go to the best, you know, get the best. If you can't do the best marketing, get the best marketer. I recognize that Vanishing Ink at that point in time wasn't able to produce a 2 DVD set. So I went to the person who was producing the best 2 DVD sets back then, which was Owen Packard and Big Blind Media. So we co-branded as Vanishing Ink and Big Blind Media. And yeah, Owen really helped get the look across that I wanted. And yeah, that was a long time ago. I watched it back recently just to watch a few things that I say on there. And I look so much younger and dorkier and thinner. But yeah, that was very much, I think we filmed it before Vanishing Ink had even launched, actually.
And where did Vanishing Ink come from? Because obviously Vanishing Ink is you and Josh. How did you guys meet? What made you decide? Because it's a difficult industry to go into, magic dealing, you know, because you've done things your own way, which is amazing. And I've said on this channel, and I'll openly say it to you and everyone else, for me, Vanishing Ink is the blueprint of how a magic dealer should be. And you've really stamped your own personality onto it and done things very differently. But when you first started Vanishing Ink, everybody was selling the same stuff pretty much, because everything went into Murphy's and everybody was selling the same thing. And I remember saying, I'd never be a magic dealer, because how are you going to be able to differentiate? Everyone's doing the same thing. What made you decide to go from, it's kind of another leap, isn't it? You went from a full-time job to being a professional magician. Now you're going from a professional magician where you've dominated, and as somebody who was a competitor of yours, you did dominate that industry, to go into something completely different. How did that happen? Like, why?
Yeah, you know, just going back on that, you know, just this is so true about, you know, we, I guess, we're competitors. And the weird thing is with magic, everyone's friends and everyone's competing for the same gig. It's so strange. And I'm just glad that, especially in the UK, magicians kind of navigate that carefully and respectfully. But yeah, Vanishing Ink, let's go through the brief history. Josh and I met when we were 16 years old. We were both filming a TV special with Lance Burton called The Young Magicians Showcase. And it just popped up on YouTube, which don't watch it, please, nobody Google it. And you know, there were I think 15 young magicians on this show, and some young magicians we still stay in contact with now, actually. But there were I was wearing a bright red suit, and so was Josh. So not suits we would wear now, but that's kind of what connected us, I guess, gave us the affinity. There's a guy a bit like me standing there. So yeah, we had a friendship, and it was cool to get to know Josh. He was a well-known magician even in his teens, so it was really kind of cool for me. And then when Josh was doing a lecture tour in the UK, maybe 12 years ago, that was when I was working in London, and I spent my weekends back home in Gloucester. So I had two places where he could stay during the lecture tour. So he ended up using my where I was living as a base, you know, either in Gloucester or London. So we spent a lot of time together, and we were talking about our goals and dreams and aspirations within magic. And it turned out we had pretty similar goals. And it's almost weird for me to talk about now, and you'll see the flaw in a second as I say it, but we both were kind of a little frustrated that when we would create something or would write a book, we would hand it over to a publisher and or somebody to release the tricks, and then they would take full creative control and they'd do what they like with it. And often it wasn't the level of quality that we aspired to have our material released in. So we decided to join forces. You know, let's try this. Let's produce our own magic together. We're very lucky that Josh and I have very much the same vision, but our skill sets are quite complementary. You know, Josh is this fantastic magician who travels the world and knows everybody in the industry. I quite enjoy working behind the scenes. I don't often, you know, I'm not desperate to be in the spotlight by any means. I have a computer programming background. I have a graphic design background, and I'm used to managing a team. So together, we actually fit together really well. And there's very little overlap in our skill set. So it actually means that when we joined forces, we just became stronger because we have that same vision, but the different skill sets. So now we essentially became what we were trying to avoid, you know, being that production company that took people's ideas and released them for them. And we learned so much that now we involve the creator in every step of the way. So we very carefully become or became different to what the process used to be, basically. And we made that decision every step of the way. You know, what's it like buying from a magic shop? How can we improve that experience? And turns out brick and mortar shops had it right. You know, you can go in and you can ask some questions. You don't want to know what's new, you want to find out what's good. And that's basically the model of Vanishing Ink. So a long-winded answer to say, I worked with my best friends and we just tried to do it the way that we wanted to do it.
That's great. And you have got to the point now where you're pretty much, I don't want to say dominating the industry because there are a couple of other big players as well, but you are definitely absolutely right up there. And there is a lot of stuff that you're doing that is so innovative. And one thing that's typified Vanishing Ink is right from the early days, you've always, the products that you guys bring out, there's kind of a real buzz around them. Some other companies will bring a product out and it fizzles away. But whenever something comes out through Vanishing Ink, there's a massive buzz. And it's happened right. I remember one of the first earliest releases was the cooler, right? It must have been early on. I remember I talked about that on the channel last week, actually. And then Timeless came out fairly early on as well, as I remember. And
really early on.
All of this, and then it was the card painting artist.
Actually, yeah.
Yeah, but all of this stuff, there's a massive buzz about it, and that's continued right up until this day. Is that because, and I've talked about it openly, I've talked on this channel about producers bringing out terrible tricks or downloads coming out that are terrible, and Vanishing Ink have never put their name to a bad product. And I know I've reviewed for the last year so many products. And I just know when a Vanishing Ink product comes in, even downloads, you know, there's another level when it comes to, it's not like a kid with an iPhone that's filming this. It's the production quality is really high. Is that because you are very selective about the tricks that you release and the people that you work with? How come you guys hit it out of the park every single time?
Well, it goes back to what I was saying about marketing. Instead of telling people that we're the best, we want to try and be the best. And it's simply that. Yeah, it's constant questions along the way of, is this something that we want to put our name to? Is this good enough quality? Is this adding to magic? And that's the question we ask the most. Does this add to magic? And for many releases, the answer is no, it doesn't. And if that's a trick that's on our brand, it goes. It doesn't even get to release. And we're really lucky. We get about 10 submissions per day. Imagine that, 10 people submitting tricks to us every single day, all books or downloads or DVDs. And you know how many we take? None, pretty much. You know, in a month, we might take one or maybe one every 2 months or something like that. We're just ultra, ultra selective because we're always asked that same question. Does it add to magic? And that just, I think, has allowed us to attract the attention of some really, really great magic creators. And, you know, the kind of magicians that we've always looked up to are now coming to us and wanting to work with us. And I think that's because, you know, who would you rather work with? Somebody who has a back catalogue of flops or somebody who really truly cares about improving the magic industry? And that's, you know, the higher quality you go, the higher quality tricks you get coming in, basically. So it's just always been the long game. We're not out for a quick buck. We don't even consider ourselves magic dealers. You know, you've said that we're that several times, and people do. And just in our minds, we're not in this to deal or sell the magic, which I know sounds crazy, but we're in it to produce great magic and add to magic. And I think that mindset has rubbed off on the whole team. And so now often the team are harder on ideas than we are. And, you know, imagine Josh and I in a meeting pitching a product, you know, pitching something. We want to do this. We want to produce this convention. We want to produce this new idea. And it's not, oh yeah, great, let's do it. There's a whole team of now a barrage of, well, no, that's not high enough quality, or we should do it like that. And actually my wife often jokes, like, is this your company? Because, you know, we've in a way encouraged the team to be constantly pushing us up. So as we grow, we find more people who are trying to push us up higher. And it's just, yeah, it's a snowball that we now have to keep this quality high, and we're trying really hard to do that.
So what advice would you give somebody? Because people come into magic, and I've talked about this on the channel before, but because you come into magic and very early on, you see these people that have been put on a pedestal and they're creators, and you kind of think, oh, I want to be a creator as well. And you see people creating magic and a lot of it's rushed out to market. What advice would you give somebody who wants to make a name for themselves in the magic community? They want to be a creator of magic. They want to be the next whoever it may be. And they want to do it through Vanishing Ink. You say that you almost say no to everybody. So obviously the solution is not to submit a trick to you. How does anybody watching this video who's desperate to work with Vanishing Ink, how do they get on your and Josh's radar and the rest of your team?
The answer comes from Steve Martin. Be so good they can't ignore you. It's as simple as that. You know, most of the tricks that we get sent are good tricks. They're not, you know, when we turn down a trick, I often worry that the creator thinks that we're judging that trick as a bad trick. That's not the case at all. You know, it's just simply, there's a level and most creators work at that level, but the only tricks that we can take are above that level. You know, we need to take tricks that are higher than the norm. So simply that. If you have a trick that is so good that we shouldn't ignore it, then we want to hear from you. You know, we still take on the occasional trick, but we have such a big back catalog of stuff that we're working on. It's kind of scary to know the number of releases that are in our pipeline right now. But if something is so, so good we can't ignore it, then we won't ignore it.
And the names that are associated with Vanishing Ink are amazing. I mean, let's talk about the masterclasses for a bit, because I talked about innovation. That is such an innovative thing. the concept of having somebody there every single week for a month is just, and having a live experience, it's great. It really is. And the names that you've got, David Regal, Assy Wind, man, Guy Hollingsworth. I mean, wow, that's incredible. What made you decide to come up with the masterclass? And, you know, and by the way, and I'll say this on the record, anybody who's not subscribed to this is an idiot, because it's the best deal in math. How you can afford to actually do this at the price that you do, I have no idea, genuinely no idea.
Well, that's the masterclass is a perfect illustration of what I was saying about Josh and I kind of completing each other's puzzle pieces. I don't know what the right phrase would be, but you know, I came up with this idea of we should do an online lecture where it's interactive. You know, that's always been missing from Magic, is actually being able to learn face to face online. We've had these lectures that are essentially just DVDs that are just, you know, somebody presses play and they stream online. So I thought, well, let's actually do it where people can come in on video and ask their questions and they can chat and have questions. You know, that's my IT background coming in there, thinking about what's the solutions to this. And then Josh's Magic background said, well, great, but what if we made this a month-long thing? What if we had multiple classes where the lecturer could go over certain subjects? You know, we could have somebody like David Williamson, who has such a wide variety of material, and he could come in and he could spend the first week could be on gambling, and then the second week could be on walk-around magic, the third could be on, I don't know, cups and balls or whatever. And so that's what we did. It's just the perfect combination of my IT thinking and of course my magic background as well, and Josh's magic background, and together we just have been able to come up with kind of fun ideas, because we know what the technology can do, we know how far we can push it, and we know what magic can do and how far we can push that.
And that brings us to the session, because obviously were you running the session before Vanishing Ink even came about?
Yeah, a couple of years before Vanishing Ink. Yeah.
Because I remember when it was first in Gloucester over that way, and then
You lectured at the second one. You did the kind of small workshops that we did.
Yeah, and it was so much fun. And then it moved down to London. Obviously, now the session is branded towards Vanishing Ink. Was the purpose of the session just because you wanted to do a convention your way? Mm-hmm. Or was it because it's changed from that first session? It's now a beast. I mean, it is a beast, isn't it? And how you continue to get that, how you must be sitting there with Josh stressing how you can top each year, because each year is just stupid, and you just think there's no way they can top this, and then the next year you top it. It must be a very stressful thing.
You know, it isn't, because of one simple solution, and it's the whole reason the session started, which is just I want to organize an event that I would like to attend. It's as simple as that. So the lecturers and performers are booked because I want to watch their lectures and their shows myself. I want to be able to hang out with them, just like all of the attendees can hang out with them. Josh is the same. So, you know, even as we grow, we always keep that mindset. We want to create a convention that we want to attend. And that's always steered us in the right direction, I found. You're right, the session started a lot smaller. The first one, there were 50 people. The second one, there was 100. Now, I mean, post-pandemic, I don't know what numbers we'll be at. But, you know, last year, I think it was 600, 700, maybe 800. I don't remember the exact number, which is kind of a lot of people. But the good thing is, it's a convention that we want to attend, which means the bigger we grow, the more we put into the technology behind it. So I've not heard from a single person who said, like, as you've grown, the convention's got worse. I've only heard from people who say, as you grow, the convention's got better, because we invest in new video technology, bigger screens. You know, we're the only magic convention, I believe, in the world that builds a custom set. So our whole convention is built from a conference set company. We have this whole staging with the video screens embedded and the lights embedded, and you know, whole backstage area for the performers. So yeah, the bigger we grow, and I'm not thinking of taking this thing massive. This is, you know, the session is not Blackpool, and it never will be. But the bigger we grow, the more we invest in it, basically. But who knows? I sense post-pandemic, maybe we have some rebuilding to do. So we'll see.
Well, obviously, next year you're putting the session online. You've already announced that you're going to do it virtually. And obviously, you've got the sister convention. Is it Magifest?
Yes, in Columbus, Ohio. Yeah.
Which, again, is going virtually. Is that going to be a challenge? Is that going to be something that you're...
It's a challenge, but one I'm kind of excited to tackle. So when the pandemic hit, you know, when the lockdowns first started happening, we immediately had the conversation of what does this mean for January next year? Can we even do the conventions? And I'll be honest, we thought maybe yes, maybe this thing would be kind of blown over by then. And I'm sure we all thought kind of naively back then, perhaps because the politicians were telling us, you know, it'll be fine by the summer. But we're planners by our very nature. So we sat down and we said, what is the scenario? What are the different possibilities and different outcomes that we can see in January? And we came up with a 5-point system of the worst case is let's call it tier five. You know, people in the UK would hate that phrase, tier five, but let's call it tier five. Like, that means that literally nobody can leave the house. And how can we run a convention in that environment? And tier four is, well, we can get the performers in a room. And tier three is we can get the performer and some attendees. And so, you know, we have this whole system in place, and that just allowed us to model out every possible scenario. And I sense we'll be in what I'll let's consider tier two by the time the conventions roll around now, as we've pushed them back to July. And tier two is going to be half online and half attendees. So
hybrid event.
My hope is we could have maybe 300 people in the room. I don't know. But right now people can register to attend online or join the waiting list, because we've already filled up the number of people we're taking for in-person registrants right now. But my hope is by July, life is somewhat more normal, especially in the UK. At the time of recording this, we're 2 weeks into the vaccine. We've vaccinated 500,000 people. So, you know, maybe the session could be a cause for celebration. I don't know yet. But all I do know is that people need it. You know, we're missing conventions this year. And normally, if this was a normal year, today I would be stressing right now about putting on all of the finishing details for the session. We're organizing this thing because we feel like magic needs it. We're not going to put it on pause for a year, because actually we need to get together and we need to find a way to do that safely if we're allowed. So there's kind of a responsibility there for us.
Now, I want to talk about your new book, but before we do, I've got one other question. You've mentioned a few times about how you haven't really performed on a regular gigging basis for about 5 years. I imagine that Vanishing Ink takes up a lot of your time. Have you missed that performing lifestyle and going out to gigs? And do you find not performing as much? Because I know you're still creating. I know that Vanishing Ink have a big hand in every product they release, and you create magic yourself. Do you find that not having that outlet where you can go out and perform regularly affects a creation? Like, you haven't got a place to go out and perform it, or is that not an issue?
It's a really great question. And yeah, I guess I should say, pandemic aside, I'm still performing actually reasonably regularly, but just nowhere near as much as I used to be. You know, I used to do, you know, all these weddings and corporate events every weekend and a few in the week. Not that I was the world's busiest close-up magician, but, you know, I was working quite a lot. And when my son was born, I realized something had to give, because I was running Vanishing Ink. I was doing the conventions, I was performing, I was lecturing. So yeah, something had to give. And sadly, the one that kind of took up the most time for the least reward was back then was the gigs. So I just cut down the number of gigs. But like I said, right at the start, it's important to me to still perform, because you can't be a good performer unless you are performing. It's, you know, the clue's in the name, I guess. So I do enough, just enough not to miss it in some ways. You know, I don't think I would ever miss driving up and down the motorway, celebrating New Year's Eve on the M5, driving home from a gig. I don't miss that, but I do miss how sharp it makes you when you're performing that often. It does make you sharp. And, you know, I'm kind of scared to go back post pandemic to that first gig is going to kind of feel weird, right? To get back into it. But at the same time, I'm extremely excited for it. So I still perform. I still lecture a lot. In January, I did a lecture tour of Canada and some parts of North America. Loved it. That's, to me, my favorite outlet for performing, because my lecture is not a lecture. It's a show. You know, it's a 2-hour show, and I love doing that. So I'm still out there performing, not as much as I wish I had time for, I guess.
And on the subject of performing, do you have any advice on how to break into television? Because you've done quite a lot on television. You've done Penn and Teller. You did Penn and Teller, right? Yeah. And you did The Next Greatest Magician. And I'm sure you've done other things as well. Those are the two that spring instantly to mind. Is that something that you had a desire to go out and do? Or is that something that kind of an opportunity that fell into your lap? And how would other people replicate that opportunity that want to be TV magicians or want to be famous?
So, yeah, you know, I'm neither a TV magician nor famous. So take my advice with a pinch of salt. But I've been lucky. I've done, over the last few years, a surprising amount of TV when I reflect on it. And a big part of that was I was a season regular for the CW channel's Masters of Magic. And, you know, that gave me a lot of airtime, and I was really proud of that. And hopefully I'll be back again post-pandemic. Not allowed in America right now because of, you know, Brits are not allowed to travel to America, or European people. Here's the advice, and it's not my advice, it's actually Josh's advice. Just before Next Great Magician, which was maybe four years ago, I said to Josh, you know, I kind of feel left out. All of my friends, including Josh, are doing all these TV shows, and nobody's coming to me. I'm not getting the invites. I'm not even in consideration for these shows. And Josh made me wake up in one sentence. He just said, "What have you done to make it happen?" And I was like, "Oh yeah, you're right. You don't just sit there and think someone's going to come knocking on the door and go, 'I've got a TV show for you, son.' It doesn't happen like that. You have to go out and get the work." And you know what? Within a week, I was in talks with The Next Great Magician, and I spent quite a lot of time brainstorming with Andrew O'Connor, and then I was put on the show. And that was then the snowball. That one conversation, that just one question, "What have you done to make it happen?" was then, you know, once I did Next Great Magician, like 2 days after it aired, I got a call from Fool Us to say, "We want you to come and do the balloon trick on Fool Us." And then that then led to Masters of Magic, Masters of Illusion. And yes, you know, it snowballed. So basically my advice is, have something TV worthy and get off your ass and get on TV to do it. And I know that sounds easy. I know it does. But, you know, if you want it enough, then you can find the right avenues to get on these shows. Interestingly, the part of the process I enjoy, and the reason I try and do as much TV as I can, is actually I love the recordings. I love standing in front of the camera, looking at how everybody's working and how this thing pulls together. Watching the TV show, I mean, there are TV clips I haven't watched back, if I'm honest with you, because I just always just love the process a lot more than the result of it.
Oh, that is really good advice. And the trouble is, it's something that a lot of magicians won't do. They'll sit there and wait for something to happen, as opposed to getting off your ass and making it happen.
Yeah, and you know, with the talent shows, that's the answer. If you're desperate to go on TV, then trust me, Britain's Got Talent or America's Got Talent are desperate to hear from you. I know that because they email multiple times a year, and I'm sure they do for you and every other magician. But, you know, I get those emails, and the conversations are easy to have. And if you have something good enough, you can get on the show, for sure.
Well, I interviewed Ross Stevens, and he talked about how it's a completely different thing now that he's involved. And I think that it's no longer, you know, back in the day when it first started, it was like, oh, they hate magic, they're going to make you look silly. That's not the case now. I mean, if you look at the final of BGT last year, it was dominated by magicians, and they were all put in by the public, which says something, right?
Yeah, and look at America's Got Talent. Shin Lim won like every, I don't know the details of it, but I think like Champions of Champions or something. Like, clearly there is a place for magicians on TV right now. And do you watch that documentary, Social Dilemma? Was kind of the big thing a month ago or 2 months ago. I
haven't watched it yet. It's on my Netflix viewing library thing, but I've heard all about it.
It's worth a watch. But there were two moments in it, aside from the tech stuff and the IT stuff, that I really found fascinating. there were two moments where just offhand people just talked about how clever and how interesting magicians were. Like they used this as like a metaphor of like, you know, these people are such geniuses, they have to work like magicians. And that actually cemented it to me that in the minds of the lay public, magicians are interesting people. And that just tells me that there's enough room for us to go on TV and do these things. So if you want to get on TV, the talent shows are almost certainly a good way in.
Well, you would know better than me, because you'll have all of the sales stats from Vanishing Ink, and I don't want to know what they are. But my gut feeling, based on being involved in the YouTube channel, is magic is just as popular now than ever before. And I think more people, I know that when the pandemic hit, people were like, oh, no one's going to buy magic. No one's going to buy a new magic trick. But there's so many new people coming into magic, and the professionals aren't the guys that buy the magic tricks. They've got their set that they go out and do and they don't change. But the hobbyists and the people that are getting into magic and the new people, they're the ones that are furiously buying every new thing that comes out because they're looking for that next latest and greatest trick. So I imagine that magic is just as popular in terms of buying new tricks and books now than it has been in the last few years, especially with the popularity on TV.
It's hard to say for sure, because at least at Vanishing Ink, you know, right when the pandemic hit, we had many conversations back then, but one of the most memorable was just between Josh and I saying, we're going to do whatever it takes to make sure that we keep every member of our team with us. Like, we're not letting anyone go. We're not letting anyone go on furlough. You know, these people are our team, our family. They've supported us, and we're going to find a way to keep them all here. So we, not just me and Josh, but the whole team, have worked harder than we've ever worked before to earn our customers' business. So it's hard to say really how the pandemic has changed the magic world. But one thing that I found really interesting is I can't back this up with any stats, but it just feels this way that we're selling a lot more close-up pads than normal. And that tells me that people want to use this time to practice. And so, you know, I'm one of these people always to try and find the positives, and there have been quite a few positives for magic in the pandemic. And, you know, I'm so impressed how, you know, if that's true, if the stats back up what it feels like, that we've sold more close-up mats, then more people are practicing magic than normal. And, you know, I'm proud of the way that magicians have totally reinvented their shows to work virtually. And many magicians are busier than ever doing the virtual shows. And, you know, that if there's any good to come from this pandemic, it's that we've proved to ourselves and the world that magic's not dead. Magic's not slow to adapt. Magic is perhaps moving quicker than it's ever moved before in 2020. And, you know, that's kind of a good time to appreciate magic. I'm sure we will change back post-pandemic, but I'm proud of what magicians have done over the last year.
Oh, it's amazing. It's inspirational. And one thing that I've seen Vanishing Ink do is when Vanishing Ink first came about, it was all about close-up magic. That was the thing. Now you're bringing out stuff like the two-headed prediction, which, you know, I reviewed on the channel of somebody who runs a kids entertainment agency. I was like, that is the best kids trick I've ever seen. That's the best trick for a family audience I have ever seen. And it's so great to see you guys diversifying out of close-up and into so many other areas as well. It's really great to see.
Oh, well, thank you. Yeah, it just comes from, you know, if we find a trick that's great, I don't care whether it's a kids trick, a mentalism trick, card trick, whatever. Yeah, that's just, there's an audience for it, so we'll get behind it.
Now, let's talk about your book, if that's okay, because that's what this has all been leading up to. First of all, I have to tell you, the trailer for your book was just ridiculously awesome. I've never seen a trailer like that before. It was so well done. Was that your idea?
It's hard to say. You know, everything is a collaboration at Vanishing Ink. I know exactly where it was born. And so I can tell you who was in the car. How about that? Driving to Belgium, actually, this is the deck of cards that we produced for the book. We're driving to Kathmandu because I wanted to check out the finish that they were going to use, and I had a few things I wanted to make sure that we got right on that deck. So three of us, me, George, and Mark. George is our general manager. Mark is one of our guys who produces the video content. And we were just talking about how can we aim to make the best magic trailer ever? And that was our goal. You know, it's a big goal, but I always set myself big goals and, you know, we'll often not hit that high height, but we'll try and get as close as we can. And we just came up with this idea. Wouldn't it be cool if it was one take that I would do a trick, that I would talk passionately about the book? And then it just evolved from there. I sat and wrote the script after dozens of failed ideas of different things that we could do. You know, the start of the trailer was like, wouldn't it be cool to have like well-known magicians walking around and, you know, me bumping into them as they're reading the book or as they're holding the deck, or, you know, and we just stripped it back, as with every element of creativity. You know, the best ideas are the ones that you just keep editing back. And then we just, yeah, eventually got to where we got to. And you know, it's a trailer where it looks like there's three people, me and the two spectators, but you know, there's six or maybe eight people behind the scenes. The cool thing is you can't see them because of, you know, I'm walking around this warehouse and they're having to all run around so that they're not in shot. So it was a big team effort, that whole process, but I'm really, really proud of what we achieved that day.
Oh yeah, the trailer is absolutely amazing. Tell me a little bit about the book, because you have written books for other people for many, many years, and you bought ebooks and obviously had lots of different projects out over the years. This is your first big book. What made you decide that now was the right time?
Yeah, so Vanishing Ink has published 100 magic books. I'd done way more than 100 projects, maybe 300, 400, 500 projects. And, you know, after every book, which I often am responsible for the editing, the proofreading and the layout and the design and the whole production process, which is one of the longer parts of the process, I'm responsible for all of those things. And after every book, I always just said to the team, you know, I'm going to spend some time working on my book now. I'm going to get this thing finished. And it doesn't happen because the next project comes in and you know, my attention is pulled away. So, I decided my family and I were going to take some time off. I've worked on Vanishing Ink every single day since we started, and I decided I'm going to take some time off for the first time. And by the way, that included my honeymoon. I was working on Vanishing Ink during, you know, days during my honeymoon. So I took some time off. We relocated to Las Vegas for a few months, and that was just the time where I just found myself writing and working on the book. It wasn't like I was like, I'm now going to sit down and finish this book. I just found myself when I had more of a free mind because I wasn't working on other people's books, and I just got it finished. So I didn't choose this time. It just kind of, the book got finished at this time, and finally I was able to release it after 10 years of trying and transfer it in between other projects.
And it's got a lot of information. We talked about the master push off. You've updated that. There's new information on there. I think there's something like 18 routines. Is that right?
I think it's 15 or 16 routines and 15 moves and techniques, including like all the different ideas with the master push off. Yeah. So it's, you know, it's not the biggest magic book in the world. It's not a small book by any means, but I could have written one of these books with 150 tricks and ideas and moves in, but I just wanted to just highlight what I feel is the best stuff from my repertoire right now. So it's, you know, there's walk around magic. There's my full kind of walk around set, which I call the fireworks routine. I think there's 12 moments of magic in 5 or 6 minutes. There's the routine I perform in parlor environments. There's some stuff I've done on the TV shows we talked about. My full magic castle act is on there. So it's just packed with material from all different settings. And then, yeah, like we say, lots of different techniques along the way as well, from master push off to my undo cut, which is this false cut I invented, and it kind of circulated around the magic world quite quickly. And I've even had magicians show it to me, go, hey, have you seen this? Do you know who this is? It's mine. That's in there. And that's really kind of taking, a lot of people are taking note of that cut, and I'm seeing it being used in all sorts of shows and stuff. So I'm really proud of that. It's full of magic, and I think it just shows my passion for magic and my passion for constructing a really clear cut effect.
And who is the type of magician that we get the most out of the book? Is it a working pro? Is it a hobbyist? Or is it something that is designed to appeal to everybody?
Yeah, I always hate that idea of trying to appeal to everybody, because I just know that if I tried, I would fail along the way. So I would say it appeals to somebody who's interested in card magic. And that could be somebody who just wants to learn a few walk around tricks or a few tricks to show their friends. But it could be somebody who wants to work on a whole card magic routine or a show, or, you know, find out what makes a good presentation, or find out how to construct a trick, you know, because I kind of built some detail into these explanations, and I have an essay at the start talking about how I construct a magic trick to be what I consider bulletproof. So yeah, there's no one audience because it doesn't focus on one area of card magic, but I just think anybody who wants to study and appreciate and enjoy learning card magic, that's the audience.
That's amazing. And it's available to buy now. You can get it from Vanishing Ink, obviously. Are you eventually going to be doing a follow-up book years down the line? I mean, yeah, I know that you've got more material. Like you said, you've put you wanted quality in there, which is fantastic. Are you going to start working on another book now?
You know, one of my pet peeves is seeing a magician who releases a book, which, you know, they spent years on, and then before the book's even out, they start talking about the next book. So that's not me. I mean, I'm not saying I won't work on a book. I have plenty of material. You know, I could fill 2, 3, 4 books with material I'm really proud of and have worked in over the years. But yeah, I'm in a rush right now. The one thing I'm really enjoying is at Vanishing Ink, we started doing, we call it the retreat. So we did one in Costa Rica in 2019, and I did a focus lecture there on, it was called Personal Revelations. And that was all about the multiple revelation routine and how over time I had learned basically that routine taught me about magic. And, you know, I used to improvise how to do the multiple revelation routine. I used to go to tables and improvise the whole routine. And then when I changed my kind of performance style, that, because now I mainly do more formal shows, you know, the audience sat in front of me, or I'm in a private dining room. I don't need to improvise anymore because I know how many people are going to be there. I know how many cards can be selected. And by knowing that I'm not improvising, I also know how I can finish the routine. So I can build in a big climax to the routine. So it's interesting that the lessons I learned about that trick revealed a lot about magic for me. So I gave a talk about that and published a booklet with it. And next year we're going to South Africa, and I have another hour long lecture that I'm not going to tip it right now because I want to keep it to the people who are attending. But that's what I'm enjoying right now. So instead of publishing a whole big book of ideas, I am really enjoying focusing in on particular subjects and giving talks about that subject. That's what I'm really passionate about.
And that's what I like about what you guys do. You have products for every single level. If you're new into magic and you don't have much money, great, there's this and this and this. If you want to spend more money, you've got the masterclasses and the session. If you want to spend a lot of money and have an unforgettable experience, you've got this, and you can go abroad and you can do this. And it's kind of like you're appealing to everyone, which is great. That's just really good.
Oh, thank you. Well, you know, it just comes from, like I said about with the session, it just comes from wanting to create things that we want to be involved in, is the truth of it. And the retreat, the whole ethos of that is that you can go on holiday or vacation with your favorite magicians. What a cool thing. And what we found happened was the Costa Rica one, we had booked Ben Earl, Rune Clan, Paul V. Hill, Danny Ortiz, and loads of other well-known magicians wanted to come along because it sounded like a great time. And yeah, we expected that, we thought it would be a real struggle to sell that. And it sold out, and I think it was 48 hours we sold all the places out, and we had, you know, our friends begging us to open up more spaces so they could come. And, you know, Mike Cavey and Tina Leonard just came and attended by themselves, you know, to be part of the experience, and quite a few other well-known magicians. And what a great, great life that we just sat around Costa Rica in the rainforest for 4 or 5 days, and we just did magic. It was, yeah, so cool.
Well, I want to wrap this up, but I've got two more questions before we finish. And I'm going to put you on the spot with one of them. Could you tell, you just talked about how you published 100 books through Vanishing Ink and 300 or 400 products. If you had to put your finger on your favorite product that you've published, you've released through Vanishing Ink, and your favorite book, would you be able to do that? I know that you love them all, but is there one that you look at more fondly than the others?
I guess the Jack Parker book, 52 Memories, would be the one, not just because that was the one that gave me my start in writing magic books, but, you know, Jack Parker was my first friend to pass away. You know, that was a very strange experience. I was, I guess, 18, 19 years old, maybe a bit older. So that was, you know, weird and just such a strange time. And I was so involved in the last part of his life to get this legacy out. So I guess that one in many ways is the one that I'm most fond of, just because of, you know, reminds me of a friend and, mean, the material is incredibly good as well. So yeah, maybe that one, but I could also give you a dozen reasons for every other project why I've enjoyed working on it too.
Okay. And last question, what's next? I mean, this is a question I've asked everyone that I've spoken to on the channel, and I think it's safe to say that I know you talk about how you're not magic famous, but your legacy is set. You've accomplished so much, both as a performer, you talked about how many times you've been on TV, but even if you'd never done any of that, Vanishing Ink has become such a force in the magic community. You and Josh are responsible for that, and that must be an amazing feeling. You've accomplished so much. If you stopped right now, shut down Vanishing Ink and said, that's it, I'm going to be a hermit and live up a mountain, people would still talk about you in a long time to come.
But, thank you.
And it's true. It's true. And I know you're very humble, but it is true. But what's next? Because I know you well enough to know that you aren't going to slow down anytime soon. You talked about how many things that you've got coming out through Vanishing Ink. Any plans, anything else? What goals and aspirations?
It's really timely that you say that, you ask that question, because every year at this time, Josh and I write an annual letter to our customers. It was inspired by the fact that Warren Buffett sends an annual letter to his shareholders. And he talks about the things that he's done well this year, as in Berkshire Hathaway, his company, things that they've done well this year, the things that haven't gone so well this year. And we also write an annual letter and we talk about our successes, our failures, what's coming up next year. And while it's really, really great to tell our customers the things that we're doing and the things that we feel where we fell short, it also is kind of cathartic for us as well, because we can get to look at the years. It goes by so quick when you're working on so many projects. And so that's kind of writing that with Josh has allowed me to start to reflect on what I want to do next. And, you know, this year for me was the year of my book. And next year is the year of performing. I want to perform a lot more, and I want to maybe hopefully put some of that online. I kind of have this weird thing. I have no interest in having more followers than other people, or, you know, getting more followers. But I do have an interest of having work that I can look back on and be proud of out there. So, you know, I think maybe I'll have some kind of social media presence, whether that's gets 100 views or 100,000, I don't know, or really don't care. But I think hopefully 2021 will be the year where I perform more and record more of what I'm doing.
That would be great. That would be awesome. Andy, it has been absolutely amazing chatting to you. On behalf of Magic, and I'm not saying anything that I haven't said on this channel a million times before, thank you so much for setting Vanishing Ink up. This is something that the industry needed, and you are one of the good guys. You and Josh, this whole company, you must be so proud of what you've set up. Thank you so much for putting all this together.
You're such a nice guy. Thank you, Craig. And it's been fun to reconnect with you. So thank you for doing it, and good luck with your channel.
Thanks very much, Andy. And everybody else that's watching, make sure that you subscribe, like the video, leave a comment, and hopefully Andy will see them. And I'll see you again tomorrow at 9 o'clock. Thanks very much. Bye.
Thanks for listening to the Talk Magic Podcast.
Magic.
Be sure to like and subscribe to the Magic TV YouTube channel.
Magic TV.
Which includes 14 unique videos every week. Whatever type of magic you're interested in, we've got you covered. Just search YouTube for Craig Petty's Magic TV, or click on the link in the description from this podcast below. Be sure to join us next Friday at 5 p.m. right here for another Talk Magic Podcast.